This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright.
You just throw like a glow effect on it. You throw particular on it. If it existed, that effect was going on a feature.
And Brock Rom.
You just go down the Avid effect reel. Put every star wipe you can find in.
Jodane Massad joins us in episode 17. Jodane is the executive producer of innovation and design at Notre Dame. From film school at NYU to story making in sports, we break down how his background has shaped his approach to building content and the fan experience.
Perfect.
Well, there we go.
Hey, what's going on? It's Justin. Just wanted to give a shout out to APM for providing the track for us here on the Creative Sports Podcast. We're doing this podcast as an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're finding us and aren't a member of the community yet, you can sign up for free at sportscreativeslack.com.
Jodane, obviously you're somebody who was a big influence in my life when you were at the Chiefs. Jodane Massad is joining us, and he's one of the reasons I'm the creative content producer I am today. With that being said, I no longer make creative content, so take that for what it's worth. Justin and Garrett always make fun of me because in my media room here, I have my Emmys behind me on the shelf.
Oh, do you?
I do. Yeah, they're right here. I'm pointing at them.
I couldn't see them.
I didn't notice.
Every single one of those is attributed in one way, shape, or form to Jodane, whether his name's on it with mine or it's because of something I learned from Jodane with my time with the Chiefs in Notre Dame. So, Jodane, happy to have you on the podcast. Jodane, Director of Innovation, University of Notre Dame Athletics. Jodane, I think a lot of people in the community know you. You were on one of our panels earlier this year about kind of creative direction, I think was really like the overarching topic of that panel. But why don't you give a little bit of overview of, because I think everybody has a unique path into sports. I think you have an extremely unique path into sports with your background in film school. So why don't you give a little bit of that and how you fell into the Chiefs and where you're at right now?
Yeah, I have to say, I typically joke about this to people, but anybody who knew me growing up would probably laugh knowing that I've had a career in sports for as long as I have had. I'm not a sports fan, and by nature I am now, but like it wasn't something that I grew up having to have in my life. And so, but I've been open and honest about that since I started with the Chiefs, since I interviewed with the Chiefs back in 2006. So yeah, I went to NYU. I went to their film school in 2000, graduated in 2004, fell in love with the documentary genre. And I realized that I as much as I enjoy writing, it's much more powerful when I write about real stuff rather than fake stuff. Because if I write fiction, I have to create a lot of believability. And I feel like my character has become too one-dimensional because I'm trying to prove a point or be didactic about something. But in real life, I don't have to write anything. I can just show what's actually there. So I've really enjoyed writing for documentary or for things that, you know, are meaningful in this world that we're living in, much more than trying to create a fictional world. And so when I got the opportunity, I went to Kansas City for a preseason game, and I had overheard that their video board director had retired or taken a new position, and they were looking to invest in creating in-house production and take over their TV shows. You know, at that time, back in 2006, you know, there were only a few teams that handled all their own production, like the Eagles, right, were one of them. They were still outsourcing with, you know, making deals with local TV networks. They were doing their preseason games. The local TV networks were doing the coaches' shows. And maybe they had started to hire video board production in-house. But that was the first foray into production for a lot of teams, certainly in the NFL. And so I thought a TV production, knowing that there was an opportunity to kind of maybe be a pioneer in bringing TV in-house, I thought that was kind of exciting. I told my wife, my fiance at the time, I was like, I don't want to get found out that I'm not really a big sports guy. And I credit her because she said, but you're a big production guy. So why don't you just own that and show them a world that they don't know yet. And, you know, learn what you can while you're there. So from then on, I just pretty much owned that aspect. I was going to bring a different perspective. I even told my team, Brock, you probably remember, it's about people, not plays. That's the only way that I was able to interpret the world that I was living in. And I found that it was very kinetic. There was a lot of work that we did at the Chiefs that got a lot of attention. And I remember one piece we did on an artist, Chris Simbauer, won an International Film Festival award in the sports show category. And it was a 30-minute show, and only 10 seconds of the entire show showed anything on a football field. The whole show was about something really on the outskirts of sports, but it was about people, and everyone can connect with that. So I realized that once I got to the Chiefs, that it was a lot of fun. You know, in film school, you talk about creating an audience, and a lot of people have to create a following. You know, you look at the big franchises that do that. But with the Chiefs, it was fun because the audience was already there. I just had to entertain them. And so I got to realize that going to work every day was going to work at a creative playground. And we were so new, we were such a pioneering group, that there wasn't a lot of road already built for us. And we really got to try new things. And you know, I remember back in the days with Brad Young, and we're doing Wirecast and whatnot. Like, every day was just kind of a new adventure. We were all trying to figure something out. And you know, every time there's a new adventure, every time there's a new challenge, we just like being proud of ourselves and saying, hey, look what we can do. And then the fans enjoyed it. So that was even more fun.
I think at the Chiefs, one of my favorite things about working there is nobody was ever afraid to say, yeah, just go try that. Right. And the expectations are what the expectations are, and the expectations are what you put on it. And I think all of us put very high expectations on it. But there was a lot of room to, you know, maybe not financially all the time, but there was always room for an idea to grow however you see fit to have that idea grow. And one of those ideas that I was a little later on, but I was very fortunate to be able to work on, was Chiefs Kingdom. Why don't you tell people a little bit about Chiefs Kingdom? I know Dane Van Wise talked about it a little bit with us in that show. And you talked about the Simbauer piece that was part of that show. What was Chiefs Kingdom, and what made you start Chiefs Kingdom? And then how did that transition you to Notre Dame?
So Chiefs Kingdom was a passion project of mine. Essentially, it was probably the epitome of everything I wanted to do at the time. And I had the opportunity to do it. So I consider myself very fortunate to have kind of created that a reality. Basically, when I had done some human interest features for the Chiefs and was loving it, and then my boss at the time, he had just come from the Eagles, Rob Alberino. He, I'm owning exactly who I am. He talked to me and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I don't know if I want to do sports, but I really like documentaries. And I was just telling him about myself. And a few months later, you know, he kind of put a few things together after I'd done a few human interest pieces, and realizing that, you know, the access that we needed to tell the kind of stories that we wanted to tell on the players was just not going to be very easy to come by in the, you know, with the character of the football program at the time. So we're like, well, where do we have unfettered access? If we have storytelling talent, where do we have the unfettered access that we're not getting within our football players and coaches? Well, we have it with the fans. So do you think that you can create an entire show wrapped around that? And, you know, we talked about it and we're like, well, we got to give it a shot. And it was so much fun. Basically, you know, it was a chance to tell real stories that could be about an individual person. It could be about an individual game. It was mostly about fans, but every now and then we were able to tell stories about players and whatnot, anything that touched the Chiefs Kingdom, right? And I remember our debut is kind of topical right now, coming off of the 19th anniversary of 9/11. But our debut was on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I remember Lieutenant Colonel Birdwell was a Chiefs fan who was caught in the attack in the Pentagon, and he lost a lot of skin. He thought he wasn't going to make it. They pushed him to the Washington, D.C. emergency room, and he had developed a fanship toward the Chiefs back when he was stationed in Kansas. And so back in that time, a lot of people knew who he was. And so when word got around at the Chiefs, in the Chiefs fan base, that one of theirs was in critical need, the city really rallied together around giving him and his wife support. And they sent these flags all over the city. They had it signed by the football players, the coaches, the fans. And it was like a get well soon. The Chiefs had played the Washington football team that season in Washington, D.C. So when they went, the cheerleaders went with the team so that they could hand deliver this quilt in his hospital room. And he still's got a picture of him, you know, receiving it and whatnot. And, you know, it just kind of gives me goosebumps just thinking about it, how this wasn't just a story about a fan who happens to be a fan of the team that I work for and happens to be a really cool person. It was also a story about how being a Chiefs fan impacted his life and how being a member of this Chiefs kingdom was very meaningful for him and his story. And being able to really connect those two together, I thought really made the show unique. It wasn't just a magazine show. It had a thesis to it. And it was certainly one of the joys of my professional life is working on that show.
So you helped build this department at the Chiefs, and then you get kind of recruited for a job at Notre Dame. Can you kind of describe that in the state Notre Dame's department was in at the time when you came in?
So I still remember the text message I got. I still saved it into my my screen captures on my phone. But I got a text message from Dan Skenzel, who was the executive director of Fighting Irish Digital Media at the time. And they were looking to hire an executive producer to help build out the production outfit for Notre Dame, and specifically for or a large part of it was with its programming opportunities with NBC and with NBC Sports Network. And I have to say, it was a very difficult decision for me to decide to finally leave Kansas City. One, you know, the Chiefs had really taken a chance on me. They'd given me tons of opportunities. It seemed like every year I was doing something new and stretching myself in a different capacity. Number two, my wife and kids and I, we loved Kansas City. It's a fun place. Our kids were enjoying it. My wife had a great job. I obviously enjoyed my job. You know, number three, I really loved my team. They, you know, were great to depend on. We did a lot of stuff together and they did a lot of stuff even on their own. And it was just really rewarding for me to just be able to spend time with them. And you know, I guess number four, like I was in the NFL and that was really cool. I think it's kind of a saying in the NFL, anybody who works there, to kind of get excited about realizing how cool a job they have. It's kind of a saying to say you're one of 32. Only 31 other people in the country or in the world have the job that you do. And that is, it's very rare. So like really enjoy it and realize that, you know, realize your opportunities that you have. And I called a lot of friends when I was trying to mull over the decision. And one of them was Mitch Holthus. And I had asked him and talked to him about his, I hope he doesn't mind me sharing this, his take on the opportunity. And basically what he said was, you know, with the Chiefs, you're one of 32, right? And I said, yeah, I know. It's such a special thing. It's a hard thing to walk away from. And he said, well, at Notre Dame, you'll be one of one. And I really thought about it. And I really, you know, I knew about Notre Dame because, you know, most people did, you know, growing up in my high school, and there's a lot of people in my high school who went to Notre Dame, but I didn't really know specifics. I had no idea about the NBC relationship. I had no idea about its history that really put itself in a position to lead. And the more that I learned about it, the more I realized that, you know, that renegade creation story about Lamar Hunt and the AFL and the Chiefs was at Notre Dame on steroids. And I just thought, man, there's so all the things I love about the Chiefs and this, the Chiefs kingdom and their perspective about flyover country. And I was going to a place that, you know, seemed to me wrote the book on it, you know, I'm not rating anything. It just seemed like it was a really neat opportunity. And I think, the other thing you'd mentioned about the state of Fighting Irish digital media at the time, it was ripe for change. It was ripe for growth. And the team that I was on was so mature, you know, like the wine was already perfect. And I wasn't sure that as much fun as it would have been to continue on the path in Kansas City, Notre Dame just offered an opportunity for me to have a much greater impact year over year, because it was starting from, you know, the very, very beginnings of something that could be really, really cool. And the sky had no limit.
So you talked about Notre Dame as a really, you know, story rich environment, all the background, all the history and all that. You know, as a storyteller, how do you decide what to tell? I mean, you know, you've got this bucket of probably 100 stories you could tell about Notre Dame. You know, how do you tier those, you know, good story, great story, must tell story? How do you decide what to, you know, approach and attack?
It's tough, but you got to start somewhere. So I try to think about what's going to be relevant today. We did this in Kansas City too. We're like, all right, let's look at the schedule. We're playing Michigan for our home opener in 2018. That's a pretty cool story because we, you know, the series ended in 2014, and that story is rich and deep. And having been at Notre Dame for, I think, 3 years before we played that season, I already had known a lot that all of my friends who were outside the Notre Dame circle had no idea about the Notre Dame, Michigan, you know, kind of birth story. And so, I thought it needed to be told. People needed to know about Notre Dame and Michigan. And B, it was relevant because we were going to play them. And so that made that story even more critical. I'd say finding relevancies to today is probably one of the, you know, remembering anniversaries or giving some context on a big matchup. I think those are probably the biggest things. And then, you know, another show that we did, I'm now transitioning to a show called Onward Notre Dame, which is basically like the Chiefs Kingdom version coming at Notre Dame. I decided to do a story on one of our student athletes, Corey Robinson, and it pretty much had a very much Chiefs Kingdom model to it because it was about a person rather than about a moment or about a something historically. And the reason to do that had a lot to do with the political climate at the time. Coming out of the summer of 2016, where a lot of social justice, you know, movements were coming to play. He was just elected as a student body president for the University of Notre Dame as he was on the football team. And he had a really interesting story about not being afraid to do anything that needed to be done. And he began a race relations weekly series on campus later in that academic year. And it was just important to tell that story because, you know, I think leadership comes from young people like Corey. I like that his dad, David Robinson, taught him that he can do anything. And so he's not afraid to try. And I even asked him point blank in the interview to kind of get the response I was wanting. I said, "Corey, you can't make a difference. Respond to this statement to me." I said, respond to this statement. I'm being a little facetious, but respond to this. You can't make a difference. People are still going to be racist. The team's not going to win all games because of what you can do to help hype the team. Why would you even put yourself through all that much work?" And he says, "You have to start. I'm not going to get daunted because I have to start. And that's what you have to do. And getting started is half the battle, because it may not finish with me, but it's going to start with me. And that's what we have to do." And I just thought that, you know, some of the, you know, from the mouths of babes, right? Some of the most pithy, you know, comments are what comes from these young people like Corey. So I think a lot of the topical thing, you know, the election that just happened and coming off of such a polarizing summer, it was just really great to hear some perspective from someone. So if there's an opportunity to make a difference or to spread a message that I think is meaningful for people to hear, I'm going to take that opportunity and value the platform that we have to do that.
I think being a good storyteller is one of the harder things to learn in this industry. I think some people are naturally gifted storytellers. I think you're a very naturally gifted storyteller, Jodaine, but obviously you've put a lot of work into that too and learned a lot through your time at film school, through your career. It wasn't just you were born and able to tell the stories you were able to tell, right? There was work behind there. A lot of younger people starting out in their career are listening to this podcast. And I was there too. And I thought early on, the most important thing was, how good does my image look, right? Do I have clean audio, clean video? Is it technically sound? What I really needed to focus on early on was the storytelling aspect, because story trumps everything. So if you were talking to a younger, new in the industry producer, what tips would you give them from the storytelling side to make sure they're doing their best to tell the best story?
Well, first of all, I can guarantee you that I was not born with anything. I look back at some of the stories that I wrote when I was young, and they're so full of holes. Like, I remember my mom would read the story and say, "But son, you never told the audience that the boy did, you know, X, Y, Z." And I'm like, "But that's, you know," like I was so poor at giving context. I was asking the audience to do mind reading. So it's definitely something I've had to put a lot of effort into. I tell people that as much as I enjoy the product of something that I've written and I'm finally proud of it, it takes me forever to do it, because I'm not in my head good at it until I like it. And so I think everyone's a better writer than me. I just spend more time at it, which is why I've probably been recognized for some of it. I would say get, you know, some of the things that I think about when I'm putting together a story. First, I think about what is it that I want someone to either feel an emotion or to learn something that's worth learning. So if you look at that Michigan example, I thought the history of the Notre Dame Michigan series was very informative and packaged the way I felt like it should be packaged. Could be a very interesting and engaging story. And at the end of the day, it's a story you could retell. So you're learning something that's worth remembering and resharing. But then if you look at the Corey piece, it was probably more appealing to emotion. And so you could get somebody, you could help an audience member feel something that maybe they haven't felt in a long time. Somebody once told me at film school, it's your job to remind people what it's like to feel. And so I think about that message a lot when I'm working on things. But then when it comes to actually putting it into a structure and thinking about the pacing and whatnot, I'm constantly reminded of a few sayings that I came across when I was in college. One of them was from Plato, and he basically said, "The beginning is the most important part of any work." And really that means that you have to have a hook. You have to make people lean in. You got to make them want more to get their juices flowing. And I really got to do that and test that, you know, theory out with Chiefs Kingdom Open and whatnot. Like, you got to really you got to make that opening so dynamic, let it tell the story, let it plant the seeds that you're later going to let grow. And give an introduction to something that is very captivating. But I also read a book from Robert McKee called Story. And part of his message is win them in the end and you've got a hit. So if you take those two things together, I think of a curve, and you have to win them in the beginning because the beginning is the most important part of the work. And you have to win them in the end because they have to leave feeling rewarded for the time that they've spent with your story. And the middle, as important as it is, it's most important to be informative, to hold their hand as you're walking them through where you need them to be so that that ending can be as meaningful as it can be. So I always think beginning, middle, and end, and that's usually how I go about it. Now, that's not to say that everything has to be a 30-minute or a 60-minute piece. You can do that same thing in 6 seconds. It's taken me a long time to realize how to do that, and I'm still learning. But, you know, 30 seconds, I'll never forget the story when our media team helped arrange the capturing of a moment where Matt Farrell's brother, Bo Farrell, surprised him with the return from Afghanistan. And we had a very limited window to tell that story for it to get the impact that we needed to have. In fact, we were basically warned, if you don't get us this video by 30 minutes after it happened, we're not using your video. Like, we're going to use something that we did on a cell phone and whatnot. So we had a very, very strict timeline. We had very, very strict duration. I think it was a total of like 35 seconds. But even in that time, we were able to give a beginning, a middle, and an end. And, you know, it was one of the greatest 30 seconds that, you know, I've ever produced or ever been a part of.
That's awesome. I love the stories so far, and bringing in Corey. I feel like when you were telling that Corey story, in my head, I was like, this is every creator, you know, content creator's mindset right now, is right. And you talked about the imposter syndrome. I guess when you are sitting down to write to start, as you've brought up a couple times, how many days, like, do you start to write, set it aside, pick it back up, come back to it later? What is that give and take? And obviously it's going to be different for every piece, but do you give yourself breathing room or other time to digest what you've written and approach it with fresh eyes?
Yeah. And I'll just reiterate, you know, the stories you're hearing from me, I wouldn't say I'm a seasoned writer. I just happen to like what I end up coming up with at the at the end. So my process is all screwed up. I try to consume as much content as possible, I think, before I write anything. When I was doing the story of opening up Notre Dame Stadium in 2017, it was the first time we had a piece that Fighting Irish Media produced that aired on NBC proper during the actual broadcast. Mike Tirico led into it. It was right before we kicked off against Temple. And it was the first time that we had played any football in our kind of remodeled structure at Notre Dame Stadium. That was a big, tall order because NBC, first of all, was giving us incredible airtime. Never in my life have I had that. So there was a lot of pressure. And the other pressure was, this is the history of Notre Dame Stadium. I got to get this right. And I've only been here for 3 years. And so I spent a lot of time that summer just reading as much as I could. I read articles that were written in 1930. I read, you know, books that were written. I tried to find, Notre Dame had gone through remodel in 97, the stadium had. And so I was trying to find some literature from them as well. I wanted to try to find similar themes that I could pull on. I have to say it kept me up at night. I probably didn't sleep well. My wife was also about to give birth to our youngest Iris at the time. And so there was just a lot in my life that I was juggling. I didn't actually write the script truly write the script until the night before we shot it. Because my head was just in so many places, and I think I just needed that. I'm not proud of it, but I think I needed that. It's the point of no return to stop researching and start putting all of those researched phrases and those storylines and the things that were simmering in my head for all summer long, and make sure that those words could go out of Jerome Bettis's mouth, you know, the next day, cause he was showing up for a shoot. Again, I don't recommend anybody follow that process. That's just a story of how it happened. Yeah, I'd say I try to get influenced by as many things as possible before I put something down on paper.
I think another unique thing about you is obviously Massad is not exactly an Anglo-Saxon last name. I think everybody's backgrounds helps them become the storyteller they are. Why don't you talk a little bit about your Lebanese background and how that's influenced your work?
Being Lebanese is very important to me. And you know, my wife is Lebanese. We try to eat Lebanese food around the house and you know, introduce Lebanese music into our kids' lives and whatnot. So there's just a very rich culture and a very rich aspect of family and of cousinhood. Everyone's your cousin, even if they're not your cousin, you call them cuz. And I think that's just been important to me, probably as something that thematically maybe goes into how we think about things and how we think about communities. And I'd say probably on the film aspect of things, I'm not really sure where I've been able to find a connection, but I know I found a film reel that my grandfather, you know, back in the 40s and the 50s, my grandfather had a film camera. It was an 8mm. And he used to, you know, my dad was like 2 years old, and my grandfather is filming this like 8mm film on these reels and whatnot. And I got a hold of it back in like 2010, and it just, you know, it gave me goosebumps to watch it because I felt a little bit behind the lens. I saw what my grandfather was doing, how he was holding on a shot for a moment to let it breathe, and then how he was panning to give the viewer, you know, to advance the narrative. And I was like, it's me. So I thought, you know, maybe that's not as much Lebanese as just, you know, family heritage in general, but it certainly made me think if I was born in a different time, I think I would want to be a storyteller any way that I could get a chance at doing it, you know. And recently, you know, I still get to do a lot with high impact projects and high visibility projects, but I've also been focused on a lot of experiential stuff or campaigns that even don't have a lot of video collateral to them. And I just find it fun. I find it exhilarating because I still go back to those rules. Can you make somebody feel something? You know, can you remind them what it's like to feel? Or can you teach somebody something, a message that's worth remembering, that's important enough for them to share? And can you do it clearly? Can they walk away telling a story about that? Because to me, that's almost the greatest metric is, are people going to tell their friends, hey, you'll never guess what, I saw this show about Corey Robinson and I learned so many different things, and oh my God, maybe you have to see it, but even if you don't see it, I learned this message and this message is important for me to pass on to you. So it's not even so important that other people watch it. It's important that the people who do watch it got it and that it becomes a part of their life.
So I think it's, you talked about rules, Jodaine. So we're going to go into the rules. I think one of the best things I learned from Jodaine is short looking room. No, attention to detail. I think before I always say Jodaine turned me from a bad editor into an acceptable editor. I'll never say I'm a good editor, but I was totally passable. And a big part of that is Jodaine, you made me have an attention to detail to the minor parts of my edits that really made a big impact, right? So it's like, how does this audio transition? And I don't want to dwell on this because we've talked about this on this podcast, but like, does this audio transition sound natural one frame this way or one frame that way? Does this video, is this video coming in here one frame this way, one frame that way? You know, and you think to yourself, a frame's not going to make a big deal. It's one frame. It's, you know, 1/30th of a second. Why would that make any difference? But then you realize, and you really sit on an entire project and you do all those little things, and then the net result is this project that's a lot more natural looking. And the other thing you taught me is that rules are important, but rules were also made to be broken if there's a reason to break those rules. And I know you and I have gotten into it a couple times about different rules, me breaking rules, you breaking rules. I never forget, there was a shot of, there was a side shot or something. I forget what it was. And I was so against it. And you were so for it. We went back and forth on it forever, forever, forever. But you know, that's what made me a better creator, is that conflict. So can you kind of talk about, when did you, have you always had this kind of attention to detail in your work as it relates to the rules, and how are the rules meant to be broken in this industry?
Just kind of had a recollection of a class I took with Sam Pollard, who was a documentary producer, editor. He's done a lot of work, I think, with Spike Lee. And I was in one of his courses at NYU. And I just remember one of the messages that he gave is that every cut needs to advance the narrative, or else it's a waste. So if you're going to, I don't think of B-roll as backup roll. I think it as, you know, I want to call it eye roll. It's intentional roll. You want to intentionally guide your viewer to something that's going to give context to what, where they need to be in order to understand the story as you're wanting them to. And so I go back to that Chris Simbauer episode. And his mom starts off the show. She talks about her husband. And of course, they both worked at Hallmark and card design. And her husband passed away from MS. And as she's telling the story, you know, I chose to cut to the series of cards that she had written about for other people to use, right? Because that's what Hallmark does. It writes cards for other people to use. And all these cards were about the love of my life, building a family, my husband, my love. It wasn't just B-roll because she was a card artist when she's talking, oh, let's just cover it with some cards. It was intentional roll. It was, let's make what she's talking about so real that it gets you, because she's talking about the love of her life and having lost it. And her job is to tap into emotion of people she's never met before. And she's felt it like no one else has. And so I go back to that Sam Pollard lesson. Every cut you make needs to advance something. You don't want to go back to a cut that tells you something you already knew. You want to go back to a cut that gives you another detail that's worth noticing. And I think that's where rules that are meant to be broken give you an opportunity to lean into that. If you have an opportunity to break a rule, but it's noticeable because it's helping shape that narrative one way or the other, then it's worth doing. I know Brock, you and I've gone a lot about, you know, whether or not you ever allow lyrics to underscore a piece. And, you know, earlier in my career, I would say absolutely not. You use the instrumental when there's like, you know, interview audio, and then you can dissolve to the, you know, full version on impact when it's time. And I still do that a lot of times, but I've also noticed that there's a really interesting dance that you can do if you really want to spend the time to do it, where, you know, the subtext of a lyricist message can actually impact a scene that you're trying to produce or a segment in a feature. Not that it's stepping on other people's words, but kind of going in conjunction with it, right? Like you're timing it perfectly. And so to me, that was a rule that sometimes is meant to be broken, right? If it can do something. You don't break a rule because you don't know about the rule. You break a rule because you know about the rule, but you know why you're breaking it.
Bingo. Everybody, underline, highlight that last point.
Well, you're editing, so you can just, you know, replay, rewind it.
Just replay it right now.
Yeah, just put it on repeat.
Yeah, and, you know, Brock, I think the reason, so obviously the Sam Pollard point is you got to make sure that your cuts are intentional, but I think the other thing is you don't want to distract. If you want your people to be in a certain space, that little glitch here or that little, you really should have L cut the audio to make that transition better. You're trying to create, in a piece, you create a suspension of disbelief and you need to maintain that. Right. So when you give them an opportunity to be distracted by something that wasn't, that you didn't give as much attention to detail, you risk losing their attention. And so I think that's all part of this experience that you want to give them.
When you go in, you were just talking about the Hallmark cards and using that as an intentional role. When you are going into a shoot, do you identify any potential shot opportunities before you go in when you're creating this feature content and have an understanding of what they do? How do you go about thinking through that intentional role ahead of time versus when you're in the moment?
I think with anything, one of my lessons at NYU was you can never have too much pre-production. I agree with that to a certain extent. I also think that at some point you got to let, it's almost like training for a marathon. You got to let the exhilaration of the event actually carry you the last 5 miles. I think most of the time people who train for marathons, I've never done it, but from what I hear, you train yourself up into a certain point, but you don't actually run the 26 miles. You know that the adrenaline of the actual game day is going to get you there. And I think the same way with pre-production, I think you need to be prepared. You need to have enough experience to know where your preparation needs to spend its time. But then you also have to get a good night's sleep and you have to be able to have your wits about you so that you can make in the moment decisions. Because if you trust yourself, you trust your ability to make in the moment decisions. And so I'd say that it starts with preparation. It definitely starts with thinking about those types of things. But it's also having your head on a swivel when you're actually there, paying attention to details, thinking about the writer aspect in you, right? Like a camera is a camera, but if you can go into a shoot thinking as a writer, you're looking for those details. You know, Anthony Shadid was a writer for the Washington Post and then for the New York Times before he passed away overseas because of an asthma attack. He was at a conference that my sister hosted in Austin, actually, Brock, back in 2005. And I just remember him telling stories about how he knew he was done with an interview. He knew he was done when he finally found his hook. It was that small detail, you know, of the teddy bear that, you know, was the only thing left hanging on placed on a mantle, right? And that kind of maybe told a story about the desolate nature of the stories he was covering in the Middle East at the time. So I think maybe going into a shoot, you kind of maybe try to go into it as a writer where you're paying attention to a lot of the things that someone with just a notepad would be paying attention to. You don't always have that luxury, right? Because I'm notorious for overextending myself and becoming a one-man shoot or a rebel without a crew. But you do some of the monotonous things so many times that even if you're also in charge of audio, you're keeping your head on a swivel and you're paying attention to as many things as you can.
Yeah, as an executive producer, you know, you're asked to lead. You know, you're asked to be in charge of a team and kind of lead this effort. How do you balance leading and management versus the actual technical hands-on side of things, you know, trying to develop your crew and all that while still needing to be very involved in the projects themselves?
Well, I think, you know, leadership is something that I've been focusing a lot on and learning a lot with. I think the best thing you can do for your team is to let them believe in themselves. I felt that, you know, back when I was in Kansas City, I even remember a team that believes is unstoppable. I don't know if I heard that or if I just came up with it at the time or I felt it, but I remember feeling that way. And if you can, as a leader, almost like a tutor, show someone that they're a lot smarter than they think they are, that they're a lot more talented than they're giving themselves credit for, that the only thing getting in their way is just a little bit of experience and maybe them not having made all the mistakes you've had, then you build that confidence and you build this experience that they can draw upon. And honestly, I think Rob Alberino, if I think about the impact he's had on my life, it's a lot of that. I think he saw something in me and in all of his teams. I think he's a phenomenal leader where he makes anyone feel like anything is possible and that they have the power to make impossible things come true. Even if he's not the one guiding it. And, you know, the same thing with Chiefs Kingdom. He really let me run with that. There's many episodes where he purposefully and happily had nothing to do with. So the first time he saw it was when it went on television. You know, I think that that's really important. And I want to make sure that I'm giving someone else that same, the same empowerment that he gave me. But sometimes teaching somebody is a little bit of taking the driver's seat and showing them. Say, well, this is how I know you can do anything, is because I can do this thing and it's pretty achievable. So if you follow this step, there's one way of doing it. And I'm sure there's a million ways that you're going to teach me, but here's one way. So sometimes if I have guys who are in kind of a creative slump, we'll just say, all right, come into the office. We're going to figure this out together. We're going to go to the whiteboard and we're going to draw something out. And they usually leave the meeting, impromptu meeting. I don't want to call it a meeting, but they usually leave that little workshop session that we had feeling so much more clear. And they came up with the idea, but it was more about us attacking it together and keeping that positive attitude that, you know, if this was easy, everybody would be doing it. And challenges are the coolest opportunities. It's really great to have a tricky problem to solve, especially if you have the confidence because you've solved enough tricky problems that you're like, I could probably solve this one too. I don't know exactly what my answer is, but I know we'll get there at some point. That's pretty rewarding. And if you can kind of build that, I tell them I build that in, that sense in your teams that you lead, they're going to appreciate it. And you're going to sit back and see them use that to do things that, you know, you only not only had a part in. I tell my team and I even tell my boss, you got to find a way to win. I credit my time at the Chiefs, actually, Herm Edwards, who's now the head coach at Arizona State. Back when I started with the Chiefs, before I got to do fun stuff like Chiefs Kingdom, I had to do a lot of press conferences. And so my own personal challenge was, okay, well, press conferences by themselves from a production standpoint are not very intriguing. Let me turn it into a speed challenge to see how quickly I can do it. But fortunately, during those press conferences, I get to hear Herm Edwards, and he usually had some great things to say. And one of them was that you got to find a way to win. You never know exactly how you're going to win a game. Arike Ogunbowale did not know before the game started how that game was going to finish. But that team found a way to win, and we need to find a way to win in our lives as well.
This is a perfect transition, because speaking of winning, Jodane, I don't know if the Guinness World Records tracks this or not, but I'm pretty sure you've won more regional Emmys than anybody in the history of mankind. I really thought we'd be in your basement with all of them stacked up behind you. But for some of our younger audiences, I think you have kind of cracked the code on what makes a good Emmy submission. And I don't want to give away all the secret sauce. You got to hold a little bit of it back. But what do you look for when you're putting together an Emmy reel for category A or B or whatever of your choice?
Well, first of all, I appreciate the question. No, I certainly do not track anything on Guinness, but I can guarantee you that that's not true. Rob Albarino, who I mentioned earlier in this podcast, he trumps me by probably double, no questions asked, and he's done it in three markets. But I am fortunate to have had the opportunity to compete in Kansas City and in the Midwest market with St. Louis, etc., and then most recently in Chicago. With my time at Notre Dame, and Chicago's in the top three markets in the United States. So it's a really great competition out there. What I would say is when you're putting together a reel, I kind of think about it almost in the same way I think of like the Plato and Robert McKee. You want to, the beginning is the most important part of the work, but you got to win them in the end. But I think of a few things. So to give some, I don't know if this is worth keeping in your podcast or not, but there are some, I guess, trade secrets. I know as a judger that people should consume an entire reel, but they only have to consume 50% of a reel. So you want to make sure that you front load your work with variety, but that you put your longest piece at the end and you start it before the 50% cuts off. And if you've done your job right, and if you can win somebody in the beginning, hopefully it's an intriguing and engaging enough piece that they'll want to continue watching it. But even if they can't, for all the time demands that all of our judges have, that you've at least given them enough of a sample of your work product, they can give you a proper evaluation. So that's one thing. I definitely think if there's an opportunity for you to make something epic at the beginning that just looks and feels awesome, maybe makes you run through a wall. That really gets your attention. And then if you can go a little bit slower and really get into their feels, maybe in the second piece. I usually try to get about four pieces in. And then the third piece, if you can add any ounce of humor, and you give a little bit of comic relief, that's definitely a good competitive formula there. And then end it with something that is, more long form, more all around, a piece that, you really were proud of that year.
Were you talking about a series? So when, like coaches show, 30-minute show right there, like different shows or?
No, I was talking about, the craft reels. Okay. So the editor's reel, the audio mixer is real, the director's real, the writer's real.
So Jodane, wrapping it up here a little bit, how you have a newer role at Notre Dame in the past couple of years, and that's executive producer of innovation and design. With that, you take on some projects, like you said, that don't necessarily have a video aspect. And one of those has been the rally branding for the football team this year and the kind of second screen companion app that rolled out this past the first weekend of college football. So why don't you kind of walk us through that and what that project has been like for you?
Well, first of all, leading the innovation design team has been a lot of fun. I focus a lot on some of our core offerings to the department being on campaign building, both the creative process of discovering campaigns, and then, creating the rollout to really make them stick, and kind of keeping a creative cohesion among a lot of the different deliverables that our, fans and student athletes will have. So the rally campaign has just been so much fun this year to do. I think of, one of the things I learned at NYU, Professor Veronique Bernard actually was a TV producer, and she said that some of her most creative ideas came when what she wanted couldn't happen. So she had to think of something else. So sometimes in limitation, you're rewarded with an opportunity to find the true innovation. And I even think about our production days this year where, we're in a pandemic. We have limited staff. We have a limited budget. Players need to be seen without their helmets because players need to be seen as people first. and our society definitely needs it right now. How do you turn that into something to where a production day can still exist? And it was so fun to say, you know, production day this year is an awesome photo shoot. We're going to do photo bursts. We're going to shoot like 10 frames a second, and we're just going to have fun. We want people to be themselves. We want them to bring their pets. We want them to tell us what's important to them, messages, whether it's social justice, brotherhood, anything that they feel that they want to, that they can amplify their voice with. We want to do that. And we want to incorporate that into our rally campaign, because people rally in their own way. You can rally as an individual. And that's, you know, one of the key things where we thought this campaign was going to be really great for us this year, is because our medical workers are rallying in their way. We have fans that are rallying in their own way. And for the time we came up with the theme this summer, everyone was at home. And for a lot of America, people are still at home. I'm still at home. So people are rallying from home. They're rallying from where they are. But in doing that, they're also rallying together. So it's like they're rallying together apart. And it's been a joy to see all of the content that comes out where our players are given, are really showcasing their personality. And NBC has loved it. And they've been putting it into their broadcast as well. And so it's just a lot of fun to do that. And really how the rally campaign started was the idea that, you know, our fight song actually begins with the word rally, Sons of Notre Dame. And in times of uncertainty, sometimes you got to go to the start to recenter yourself. And going to the start is, let's go back to the top, rally. We know this is true. We know this is who we are. We know this is what we do. So we're going to do it this year, like any other year, but certainly with a different level of importance. So building out that campaign was awesome, and seeing the players run out with rally patches just gave me goosebumps. Just to know where that came from, and actually the idea, the word rally came, that concept came from somebody who had just graduated Notre Dame, I think last year, and so it was very much, you know, out of the mouths of babes. It was awesome. A former student who had come up with it. And we kind of wrapped it into a presentation, pitched to coach. He loved it. So we were able to run with that and build a campaign on it. But going into Rally House, which is the second screen experience, this has been a really, again, that you think about the limitations that you have at a time and you see, can you turn that into an opportunity that didn't exist before? People are not, you know, fans other than students are not going to be in our stands. We need to figure out a way to keep them engaged remotely. And we built Rally House as a way for any fan, free to season ticket members and certain donors and Monogram Club members, but available to anybody for a ticket price, to enter the Rally House and host their own watch party, be a part of a celebrity watch party, be invited on stage to their house. Have them drop in on your party, and, you know, have a chance to meet one-on-one with other fellow Notre Dame fans and other, you know, Notre Dame celebrities, for like these 60-second video conference rapid bursts, almost like speed dating. Hate to use that term, but it's that's kind of what it's like. And create an experience, create a memory. See if you can create something that, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, see if you can create something that people will want to tell their friends about. Oh my God, I just met Julian Love. He was in my living room. My son got to see him. We took a selfie. It was so unexpected and so awesome. If you can kind of create those moments, then it doesn't matter whether or not I'm producing a video or not. I'm producing the same emotion that I was hoping for. And people love experiences. I went to an innovation conference in Boston in 2018, and somebody from the Harvard Business School gave a presentation on a study that he had actually collected with data saying that consumers will spend more on an experience and feel better about it than they would on services or goods that are almost always have buyer's remorse or stress. leading up to the purchase. So if you can get people to make an emotional buy that's going to somehow enhance their time, then you're creating an opportunity for, you know, a level of memorable engagement. And I think that's, you know, if you think about when people think about their own life, it's a series of memories. And if you can place yourself as one of those memories in a positive light, I think that's pretty neat.
Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over into the sports creative community on Slack and connect with us and your other fellow creatives. The quickest way to get us to stop this podcast is to not tell anyone about it. So leave us a 5-star rating and don't forget to subscribe so you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.